Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
If you enjoy our show and you find our research interesting, please leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does go a long way in helping us out. You can find more about us and the research that we do by heading over to Instagram and searching our name. As always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And John, would you come with us?
I'll come to the house and give you access, but I won't come inside. I'm sorry, guys. I really appreciate all your help, though. And I hope you find something, and don't in equal measure.
Tonight we examine the location that featured at the heart of the story in the previous episode. If you haven't listened to part one of this two-part series, I urge you to go back and check that one out first, before listening to this one. Because, well, it's not going to make much sense otherwise. In part one, one of our listeners by the name of Jonathan reached out to share with us his experience of living in a rural farmhouse in Mid Wales in the early 2000s. He had moved there with his mum and dad while he was still a teenager, and gradually, over the course of a few years, strange phenomenon in that house gradually drove a wedge between the family, thus instilling fear and despair within them to a point of breaking. Whilst Jonathan was confident that the phenomenon was very real and very disturbing, he was at a complete loss for what it could actually be. What specifically was causing the events and why was it happening? Jonathan's family were not religious or superstitious in any way whatsoever, having an entirely secular view of life, society and culture. This made the events all the more difficult to them to explain, understand and come to terms with. That's not to say that religion has all of life's answers. More so, that it can provide an explanation for matters of a more spiritual matter than science seemingly can, or at least by current research standards. After around 20 years of wondering and a family who refused to seek help from anyone, Jonathan reached out in the hope that we could provide advice or some sort of clarity regarding the events at that house. If nothing else, he felt, then hopefully this type of phenomenon has occurred to others, and he hoped that Dead Souls had the knowledge and experience to be able to share some information which would provide him with closure over the events. We can and did provide Jonathan with volumes of information and details of similar events that we have researched and logged over the years. There was no doubt Jonathan was not alone, nor the first to experience what he had. He was happy to learn of similar events all over the world. But we were honest and upfront with Jonathan that to get specific information and data that's personal to him and his story, that would require some research and investigation about him and his ex-home specifically. Jonathan was completely open and accepting of this, allowing my team and I complete unfettered access to his house in Newchurch, Mid Wales. In tonight's episode, we are going to talk about that research and investigation and share with you what we found. This is Newchurch, Part 2, The Investigation. Is it possible that ghosts actually exist? Certainly many people believe in the existence of ghosts, a spirit left behind after someone who is alive has passed away. A 2021 YouGov poll found that 2 in 5 Americans think that ghosts exist, and 1 in 5 say that they have encountered one. The survey of 1,000 American adults found that many people aren't convinced that these quote-unquote entities are just the stuff of horror stories and horror movies alone. If they are right, then that's more than 50 million spirit encounters just within the continental United States. Through my work within the fields of research and psychology, it's not uncommon for me to hear stories about paranormal experiences. But along with others who practice scientific skepticism and operate in similar fields of interest, I ensure I keep an open mind while maintaining that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. If you tell me you went to see a movie with friends at the cinema, and I'll take your claim at face value. However, if you share with me that you spent 2 hours the previous evening having a conversation with the ghost of Elvis Presley, then I'll want more evidence. Hey, call me untrusting if you like. So, first of all, and in the spirit, pun intended, of critical thinking, let's consider the following question. Are ghosts even scientifically possible? The average person may think that they're experiencing ghosts when they hear strange voices or see moving objects without physical interference. People may even claim to see orbs or wisps of light, and in some extraordinary claims, state they have even seen translucent people. Yet there are no known claims of anyone describing ghosts as aging, eating, breathing, or using bathrooms, basic human traits. Ghosts, again, are rarely reported as engaging in two-way reciprocal conversations with the living. I'm talking about ghosts now specifically, not poltergeists nor demons, just to be clear. So could ghosts be made of a special or specific kind of energy? Albeit an energy that hovers without dissipating? If that's the case, that means when ghosts glow, move objects, or make sounds, they are actually acting like matter. Or in simple terms, they are behaving in the same ways that something that takes up space and has mass would do. Wood, water, plants, animals, and humans are all examples of this. Whilst conversely, when ghosts are claimed to pass through walls or vanish, then they do not act like they are matter with these traits. There is no known, proven scientific phenomenon that is matter and not matter at the same time. This is a key point, an important piece of information. You see, centuries of physics research has found nothing like this actually exists. And this is why scientists say ghosts do not and scientifically cannot exist. In February 2017, Professor Brian Cox appeared on BBC Radio 4's The Infinity Monkey Cage program. Whilst discussing the intersection of science and the paranormal, Cox is quoted as saying the following, quote,
"If we want some sort of pattern that carries information about our living cells to persist, then we must specify precisely what medium carries that pattern and how it interacts with the matter particles out of which our bodies are made. We must, in other words, invent an extension to the standard model of particle physics that has escaped detection at the Large Hadron Collider. That's almost inconceivable at the energy scales typical of the particle interactions in our bodies."
The hokey American astrophysicist cum celebrity talker Neil deGrasse Tyson was also on the same show. He went on to press Cox for clarification, stating, quote, "If I understand what you just declared, you just asserted that CERN, the European Centre for Nuclear Research, has just disproved the existence of ghosts." Cox replied to this question with a simple yes. Of course, Professor Cox's assertion relies heavily on the Large Hadron Collider's ability to pick up the tiniest bursts of energy found in particle collisions. That would effectively mean that any detectable energy signatures from paranormal entities, no matter how small, even down to the molecular level, should be easy to detect. Of course, all we need to do now is reduce the Hadron Collider in size to that of a PKE meter so we can dispose of hauntings at every ghost-infested location. Where is Dr. Spengler when you need him, eh? But what if a ghost or apparition isn't an energy, however? Well, I'm going to come back to this point in a short while, so put a pin in it for now. First of all, I want to talk about paranormal investigations. Because we're going to discuss shortly the investigation that we conducted at Jonathan's old house. So I think it's important that we discuss this point first. Never before in history have people recorded so many ghost encounters, thanks in part to mobile phones, cameras, and microphones. Even though the paranormal and subjects of the supernatural were arguably more in vogue and popular in the late 19th century and early 20th century, the advances in technology has meant that experiences are at a far higher level than those recorded in Victorian times. That being said, you would have thought that said technology would have also captured undeniable evidence of ghostly encounters by now. Some people will say that it has, though scientists will rubbish those claims. Sure, there are lots of ambiguous recordings impacted by bad lighting and faulty equipment out there, but popular TV and YouTube programs on ghost hunting convince members of the public that these blurry images and over-the-top emotional reactions are all the proof that's needed to evidence the existence of ghostly phenomenon. Ghosts are big business, after all. Television shows, movies, books, podcasts, and YouTube content aside, there are also dozens, perhaps hundreds, of ghost hunter or so-called paranormal research organizations across North America, Canada, and the UK. Small groups of self-educated ghost experts who lurk in the dark at reputedly haunted locations, hoping to glimpse or photograph a spirit. Some of the most famous TV ghost hunters are Jason Hawes and Grant Wilson, the two plumbers who moonlighted as paranormal investigators in their spare time. They were seen on the popular reality TV show Ghost Hunters, where they would essentially travel to alleged haunted locations and look for evidence of ghosts. What they would consider evidence on their show would be cold spots, photographic anomalies, they referred to as orbs, items moving of their own accord, and various other spookiness. All of which, of course, was generally difficult to verify the accuracy of and truthfulness of in a television format. Not that I'm dismissing any of their experiences, of course. I'm just being factual here. The two plumbers are working-class, blue-collar workers, making them highly popular with the viewing public, as they were relatable and just average guys. But neither had any scientific background, training or knowledge, or an education level higher than a high school diploma. While you absolutely do not need to be a scientist or hold a degree to search for ghosts, the duo, much like many ghost hunters out there, really could benefit from critical thinking and legitimate and scientifically accepted methods of investigation, data logging, unbiased research methodology, and testing techniques. Hawes and Wilson actually do claim to be skeptics, even though they are extremely credulous and seem to have no real understanding of scientific methods or real investigation. But the exact same can be said for other paranormal personalities, like Zach Bagans, Salmon Colby, Seth Borden, and Twin Paranormal. Audiences don't seem to wonder why these self-titled expert ghost hunters always fail to find credible evidence to prove the existence of ghosts, yet experience alleged amazing phenomena and spooky happenings in every single episode that they put out. It only takes some cursory research of these shows and investigators to see that the devices and methodology they use to capture sounds, electrical fields, movements, and infrared radiation may look scientific, but sadly, they are not. Of course, measurements are worthless without some knowledge of the thing that you're measuring, after all. I think you will all agree that to robustly and thoroughly measure and provide scientific evidence of something, then only the most reliable methods should be used. I think that's a fair statement, right? Yet, often this isn't the case in ghost hunting. This may be due to the thought of ghosts and the paranormal being elements of the fantastic. Hollywood horror movies have us believe that ghost encounters are chilling, quick-paced, and filled with incident. I think a general feeling is that real-life encounters and investigations should be the same if they are to be credible. When, in actual fact, the scientific reality of any research and investigation is the process is slow, rarely event-worthy, and often takes many hours and days of repetition, often with little or no results. In fact, for most paranormal and ghost investigations, the presence of a team of people at the location is not even required. A simple setup of equipment to log data over time is enough. You certainly don't need to lurk around in the darkness with a torch for the most part. Often, The less scientific the methods and equipment being used, the more likely a researcher is to find alleged evidence of ghosts. Think about that. Ghost hunters often use a variety of creative and somewhat dubious methods to detect a presence at the location. Virtually all ghost hunter groups claim to be scientific, and most will share details of the high-tech scientific equipment that they use. Geiger counters, electromagnetic field detectors, ion detectors, infrared cameras, and motion detectors, for example. Hell, each item I have listed here are some of the items that my team use too. But the equipment is only as scientific as the person using it, and their understanding and knowledge of what exactly they are logging and doing. For example, you may own the world's most sophisticated thermometer, but if you are using it as a barometer, your measurements are worthless. And actually, I have often seen people using the latest and most sophisticated cameras to capture incredibly detailed and the highest definition images, yet their knowledge of the equipment and photography in general will still produce grainy, poorly framed, and generally crappy images. Think of it in this way. Anyone can buy and use a calculator relatively effectively, but that doesn't make you a mathematician. Equally, using a scientific instrument doesn't make you a scientist. But I'm not here to bash ghost hunting teams. I'm also not for one second suggesting that these groups are malicious in what they do in any way. I'm just trying to assert that true, genuine, and proper scientific evidence of ghostly phenomenon is very rare, and none exists that categorically evidences the existence of quote-unquote ghosts. At least, none that we know of. What is available, though, is collated evidence of data that poses significant questions and anomalous information. I believe it's in this data and the anomalous information itself that we will eventually find answers. One of the many issues with evidencing ghostly phenomenon is that it cannot be tested or recreated under laboratory standards. The 1972 Philip experiment aside, of course, which is a discussion for another time. All ghostly research needs to be done in the field, seemingly on the phenomenon's terms, which in itself puts most scientists outside of their comfort zones. Zero controls also makes for shaky research data, so it would take a great deal, and I do mean a great deal of robust evidence, for the scientific community to even take notice of any positive claims towards answering the ghost question. Personal experiences with ghosts can be misleading due to the limitations of human senses. This is why anecdotes can't substitute for objective research. I touched on this briefly in my previous episode. Did you know that in a court of law in the UK and United States, an eyewitness statement is considered to be the weakest form of evidence? This is because it's known and accepted that what people see and hear cannot always be relied upon or accurate despite our assumption to the opposite. Alleged hauntings usually have plenty of non-ghostly explanations, of course. Video footage of orbs that you see in abundance online. Well, videos capture many small particles of dust blowing or floating close to the camera lens. These are often made to bloom by the camera's infrared lights or sensors. Watch any orb video closely, and you'll see that they never go behind any objects in the room. And that's exactly what you'd expect with dust particles close to the camera lens. The dust particles, or orbs if you like, are not moving with intelligent manipulation. Personally, I'm not sure where the public's obsession with orbs came from. I have yet to personally see any convincing evidence that a ghostly orb is anything other than dirt or dust. I absolutely welcome any of you guys reaching out or sharing footage with me that could change my mind, however. I'm always open to conversations with you guys. Next up is voices and sounds. I mean, I don't think I have to explain how old houses and buildings can exhibit a number of sounds, from wind blowing through gaps in the structure to old pipes banging, heating systems causing sounds, animal and wildlife within the building, and even creaks in wood and pressures in metals. These all contribute to a location that is far from consistently and naturally silent. Buildings are also often situated closely to other structures, and oftentimes sounds and indeed voices can transfer through walls and in through windows and openings. We have to consider all of these factors before we can attribute the sounds to a wider range of causes. And as part of any investigation, camera mics can pick up on these sounds but not show their cause or origin, making for seemingly spooky footage. Then there's moving objects. Vibrations in a room can affect the physical environment. Vibrations from traffic outside or machinery within the building, even if it cannot be seen or heard, can also cause items to move. A draft or breeze can cause items to fall, or slow forces of gravity over precariously balanced items can take time to cause an item to eventually move. But what happens when all of these can be ruled out? Because sometimes that does happen. In 2019, for example, my team and I were invited to come and observe a location in Somerset, England. We had been speaking over the course of a few weeks to a lady who had contacted us to say that things were moving on their own in the small bookshop that she owned. The phenomenon was not particularly large scale or shocking, but it was enough to scare the woman slightly. She didn't immediately suspect any kind of paranormal explanation. More so, she asked if we could look into what was causing it, so that she could prevent it in the future. The type of experiences she was having was books seemingly flying off shelves and items going missing, then reappearing in locations where she could not understand how they had got there. The incident came to a peak when two window blinds seemingly pulled down with no one else in the shop and the owner being nowhere near them. The events definitely interested us, so we headed down to Somerset. On the first day, the three of us spent a few hours in the shop with the owner, and nothing much out of the ordinary occurred. On the second and third days, one of my team worked each day in her shop while the owner took the days off. Again, nothing was observed as out of the ordinary. On the fourth and final day, the three members of my team, which included myself, again spent the morning in the shop with the owner, where again, nothing out of the ordinary happened. At around 2 p.m, we all decided to head out and get lunch, and the owner closed the shop for an hour to come with us. We'd left a GoPro camera on the counter next to the till. This was left on record for the entire duration. When we returned, the GoPro camera was gone. It took all four of us around 30 minutes to finally find it. It was on a shelf above the till. Now, the shelf was where the owner stored boxes of bookmarkers that she sold. The bookmarkers were placed on a little stand next to the till for customers to choose from, but the box of stock was kept on the shelf above. The owner and us discussed if, when she replenished the stock, had she mistakenly put the GoPro on the shelf above too. She was certain that she hadn't, but it was a possibility that we had to consider. There was a simple solution though. Just check the video footage, of course, which we did. What the footage shows was that the camera seemingly ran out of battery just as it showed all four of us leaving and locking up the shop, a battery that was fully recharged that morning. Incidents like this are what I find interesting. Situations where seemingly no known simple explanation can be found. Whilst it doesn't solidify any evidence of, well, anything, it certainly does give food for future thought. So let's talk about Jonathan's house. We arrived in Newchurch on a freezing cold Wednesday, January the 17th, 2024. It was a little after 3 p.m. Jonathan certainly wasn't kidding when he said the house was rural. We also hadn't seen anyone during our drive in through the village. Jonathan was there when we pulled into the garden, sat in his car with his back to the house. "I don't even want to look at that house or risk seeing something through the windows," he told us. He was noticeably anxious. Jonathan gave us the keys and went over a small bit of information regarding the house basics. Where to turn the power and water on, the exits, information about a back door which had a stiff lock, and a mobile phone black spot in some rooms upstairs. After some pleasantries and an agreement to drop the keys off the following Monday at John's house around 27 miles away in Crickhowell, he left and we headed inside. As you would expect from a holiday rental and a house like this, the interior was decorated beautifully, fully embracing the original rustic features you'd associate with a rural Welsh farmhouse. The positive for us meant that we wouldn't be slumming it this week and would be staying in comfort. As usual, and for clarity, there was three in my team. Myself, Grace, and Mark. Long-time listeners of the show will know this is far from our first investigation. So after making some coffee, we immediately got to work in setting up our equipment. Now this is the technical bit, which I know certain listeners really like to know the specific details about. The equipment we brought consisted of various numbers of the following items. A Trifield TF2 electromagnetic EMF meter, a Leighton X MF/30K Gauss meter, Jadashay GC01 Geiger counter, Infiltech Infra 20 infrasound monitor, Protmex MS6708 sound level monitor, Steinel IS140/2 motion sensors, Semitech 10P thermopile non-contact thermal detectors, GoPro Hero 12 cameras, Olympus DM770 audio recorders, Gudequi double beam IR detectors, and Spiritbox SP70 Rev 6. Now, we aren't the Warrens, and we are thankful for that, nor are we Harry Price and his National Laboratory of Psychical Research, or the UK Society for Psychical Research. Each of those teams or organisations have their own agendas and research techniques. We will be conducting our own, to our own measured standards based on the science that we have been trained in. Research and document, not to interfere. Similar, I guess, to how animals are researched within the wild. We definitely are not here to bust ghosts, Dan Aykroyd or Bill Murray style, though, yes, I am slightly disappointed about that, and who wouldn't be? Anyway, we immediately go to work setting up the equipment that we brought with us. The focal areas that we had already established were the stairs, the room upstairs the family called the spare bedroom, the kitchen, and the upstairs hallway. This worked out perfect for us. The family never reported any phenomenon in the living room or the small room beyond that that was used as the family's study and the adjoining conservatory. So we set up our laptops, monitors, and base of operations within the conservatory area. Through our coverage of infrared beam motion detection, which was set up in a grid format, we had covered every inch of the stairs, spare bedroom and upstairs hallway, completely securing it from a movement perspective. If there was any physical movement from a phenomenon which contained matter, we would absolutely trigger the sensors in those locations and log the data. Similarly, we had visual cameras in those locations, shooting in both regular spectrum and infrared optical outputs, temperature gauges, EMF sensors that could detect changes down to the most microscopic of milligauss units, and Geiger tech and infrasound monitors. There was no opportunity for any change in the environment from a multi-sensory or interfactor basis. If a fly had a bad cold, we would log its temperature and its sneezes. Now, whilst we did focus on the pre-established areas of previous phenomenon, we also covered every other room in the house with cameras, temperature monitors, and EMF meters, just to be thorough, and also added cameras to surround the exterior of the property. As a final level to our measures, we added exterior motion detectors to both doors, front and back, and to the exterior of each window. These, as I'm sure you can work out, were not for anomalous phenomenon, but more of an environment control. Whilst we also brought a spirit box with us, that's more hokey pseudoscience, so we kept this to one side and would only use it should any actual phenomenon be logged. Think of it as a screw it, let's give it a shot kind of gadget. So we activated our gear, made another coffee, then settled in on that wintry January night. We decided not to activate the water or heating systems in the house, so we could limit any misunderstood clanks and bangs and other such infrastructure-related sounds that we may encounter. And as such, the house was bloody freezing. Now, I'm not going to give you a play-by-play, minute-by-minute list of everything that happened for the 5 days that we spent in that house. The reason being is that for the most part, for 98% of the time that we were there, absolutely nothing of any interest happened at all. What I am going to do is summarise the events and focus on a few brief instances of interest. So, Wednesday night came and went with no reported data changes. Thursday, day and night, similarly, came and went with again no reported data changes. Friday, however, our alarms tripped in the kitchen area and our detectors began logging movement and heat changes. This was despite the fact that the three of us could not hear anything through our own senses. So we didn't immediately rush to the kitchen to check. We wanted to see this instance play out. So we flipped on the monitors to view the kitchen. Heat was still being logged at a slightly higher level, and the motion detectors had been tripped 3 times, though we weren't seeing anything on the cameras. Mark pointed out that there was a small increase on the EMF/gauze record that was far too small to be a human, and that all kitchen appliances were disconnected. Then it made sense. Mark and Grace headed into the kitchen. There it was. On the floor by the back door was a small field mouse. They both waited patiently to watch where it left the room so that they could block the hole up with wire wool and silicone. A false alarm, but something that certainly got our adrenaline going for a short period of time. And it was also a good test for our equipment, which we now knew was fully working. But then, later that night, around 1:10 a.m., our audio sensors tripped and began recording. Grace and I were asleep at the time, but Mark quietly woke us. We could see that the audio levels being sensed were fairly high, certainly enough for a human to hear quite plainly and without significant effort. The sound registered at 39.4 decibels. But what was being recorded was very, very faint, far lower than the decibel output would suggest. The sensors picking up the sounds were at the top of the stairs specifically. I slowly moved into the living room quietly to try and hear things for myself. Faintly, ever so faintly, I could vaguely make out the sound of what appeared to be footsteps. They were hard to pick up at first, but they almost certainly got clearer. The footsteps sounded like they were walking on a hardwood floor, although the whole house was carpeted, so this was strange in itself. The dataset continued to collect the sound at between 39 and 41 decibels. The data was specific only to the audio sensors on the stairs area. It was incredibly isolated. The cameras and motion detectors had not tripped. Neither was there any EMF output at this point. This was particularly interesting because what this suggested was that there was movement without mass. Now, I'm going to play a clip of that audio. Remember what I said. This was recorded for some reason at a lower decibel level than the audio sensors were logging, and certainly quieter than what Mark, myself, and Grace could hear downstairs in the living room. And please, let me know what your thoughts and interpretations are, and if you think that this sounds like footsteps to you. It's fairly ambiguous, and I can totally understand if you aren't hearing what I am amongst the audio, but I definitely thought it was worth logging, especially given that it was the exact kind of sound that was reported by Jonathan and in the exact same location within the house. Following this short event, things quietened down in the house for the remainder of the night, but we did conduct a detailed examination of the area that the audio was logged. Specifically, was in the hallway at the very top of the stairs. We couldn't find any evidence of, well, anything having been there. Incidentally, on each step of the stairs, the floor of the spare bedroom, and across the upstairs hallway, Grace had sprinkled talcum powder over the floor once we had set up all the equipment. For those of you unsure why she did this, it was to establish that if someone, an animal, or anything else had walked in those areas, they would have left track marks in the powder without any quick ability to recover them up. It's actually an old CIA spy trick from the 1950s, and it's basic but effective. The next day was a Saturday, and that was entirely quiet and uneventful too, with zero interesting data. Well, with the exception of a bird that flew into the conservatory window and gave us all a scare, but that aside, nothing. And for those interested, the bird was fine. After hopping around outside for a bit, it soon flew off. The final bit of evidence that I want to share with you occurred on the Sunday night, our last night in the house. The three of us had decided that for the last night we would spend the night in what was Jonathan's old bedroom. And for the most part, it was another quiet and uneventful night. But at around 4 a.m, audio sensors were triggered once again in the upstairs hallway outside the bedroom that we were in. We had each slept through this recording and only discovered its existence when we woke up at around 9:30 the next morning. Now we hadn't, as I clarified earlier, activated the water or central heating systems within the house, so the piping throughout the place was entirely dormant for the time that we were there. So this little set of noises really perplexed us. Now, both clips that I have played for you tonight may be nothing more than natural and entirely explainable information. I am not for 1 minute suggesting this is evidence of ghostly phenomenon. What I am saying is that this is some evidence that we collated within a house where a lot of unexplained phenomenon has occurred over the years. I invite all of you to reach out and share your thoughts and opinions on what you thought we managed to log, or let us know if it's entirely nothing in your opinion. We welcome you all. Disembodied voices in the dark of the night, strange apparitions, a chill down the spine and the hairs on the back of your neck standing on end. Many people claim to have experienced spooky things for which they can't explain. We know that half of us will immediately assume the supernatural, whilst the other half will entirely dismiss anything outlandish and break it down to entirely real-world causes. I'm going to end tonight's episode on two elements of thought that we haven't discussed yet. In 2023, Dr. Shane Rogers, who is a civil and environmental engineering professor at Clarkson University in New York, completed an investigation into alleged haunted houses. One thing that stood out to him that was apparent in all of these locations that he had seen on television was the age of the properties. "You never hear of ghosts haunting a new build, do you?" he said. He paid particular interest in the link between the properties and potential mould within the premises. Dr. Rogers had noticed strange behaviour from his own children after they were exposed to mould that was found in his family home's basement. It was this that triggered his investigation in the first place. Dr. Rogers found significant links between old damp houses to abnormal behaviour. And in each scenario, there was evidence of fungal mould being airborne within the property. Many of the symptoms humans experience after mould exposure do actually corroborate with what humans display in reports of ghost sightings. According to the UK's National Health Service, Aspergillus mould, which is commonly found in old and damp buildings, can cause shortness of breath and optic nerve inflammation. What's significant about this is that the nerve inflammation also causes dark shapes to seemingly float across people's vision. Stachybotrys, commonly referred to as black mold, has been proven in laboratory tests on animals to trigger an anxious feeling of fear, much in the same way that infrasound also triggers the same feelings, whilst the person experiencing the infrasound is completely unaware of it playing into their ears, such as the limited audio range of a human. This, of course, is all very interesting and an extremely plausible set of explanations. But how does mould cause recorded sounds, such as footsteps and bangs within the walls, for example? I'm referring back to the two instances that we logged in Jonathan's house. Both instances were audio that was picked up by sensors, whilst there was no physical source or matter-based origin of the sounds. EMF data, Geiger data, and heat changes were all nil. So was the source of these sounds real world? Which brings me to my final point, human psychology. Is it possible that a combination of real-world factors can influence a reaction in the human psychosis that causes the events that we perceive as a ghost? Is the human mind capable and able to manifest real-world influence through the mind alone? Bringing into discussion elements of extrasensory perception, mind control, precognition, and so on. Science hasn't been able to disprove this, so I guess it's still very possible.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.